This is the One Thing Podcast, and I'm your host, Dr. Adam Rindy. The One Thing Podcast brings together leaders in functional and naturopathic medicine to discuss actionable information that may unlock puzzles in the areas of gut health, brain health, metabolism, and longevity. Please note, these episodes do not replace the opinion of your doctor. They are not intended to diagnose or treat any condition. Please discuss this information with your provider and discuss your own unique personal health history before adapting this information. Please subscribe to our episodes so that you can stay on top of the most current information in these areas of medicine. Hey, everybody, it's Dr. Rindy. It's so great to be back. The next episode of the One Thing Podcast. It's been a while. Good to have you here. I just wanted to make a quick announcement before I introduce this week's guest. So this episode is dedicated to a organization called the Alzheimer's Prevention and Reversal Project. Website is aprpfoundation.org. If we are able to reach 500 listens within the first 30 days, we'll make a donation in honor of our guest to this foundation, the Alzheimer's Prevention and Reversal Project. So now, a quick word about our guest. And this is Dr. Kristen Burke, who is the founder and medical director of True Health Center for Precision Medicine in Northern California. She's a triple board certified functional medicine physician, entrepreneur, author, educator, and researcher. She's an expert in the reversal and prevention of chronic diseases such as dementia, diabetes, heart attacks, and strokes. She has a special interest in conditions related to mold-related illness and also is an expert in understanding cardiovascular aging, cardiovascular disease process. In this episode, we go deeply into discussing the glycocalyx endothelial layer and endothelial tissue. This is sort of the ground floor, staring face to face at the cardiovascular disease process. All things related to plaquing, coronary artery disease, atherosclerosis are all related to this endothelial layer, and more importantly, the glycocalyx layer that is connected to the endothelial layer. We're going to talk about what this glycocalyx layer is and why it's so important in regulating the cardiovascular system and its connection to things like high cholesterol, hypertension, diabetes. We'll go into talking about what you can do about making sure that your glycocalyx layer is healthy and intact and is preventing plaque formation and cardiovascular disease. So without further ado, welcome to this next episode of the One Thing Podcast. So great to be here with you all. Dr. Burke, welcome to the One Thing Podcast. It's so great to be here with you today.
Thank you, Adam. Thank you so much for having me. And I'm really excited to talk about what we have planned.
Yes, so I am as well. And I know this has been a long time coming for me. I've just been really looking forward to this discussion. So many important things to talk about today. So I thought it'd be great to get started just hearing a little bit about your practice and what you focus on in practice, and also just a moment in your clinical experience that maybe changed the way you practiced or really had an influence on who you've eventually become as a clinician.
Yeah, well, I've actually had a couple of those moments that have shifted me greatly. I currently am the founder and the medical director for the True Health Center for Precision Medicine. So that's what I do now. But my start in my career is I ran a family medicine group practice for about 17 years. And it was a conventional volume-based practice, and we had a lot of patients. We were very popular in the community. It was a good practice. But what I recognized over that period of time is that I wasn't necessarily getting people better. I was just managing their decline, following the guidelines, prescribing the medications that I was supposed to prescribe, just doing all of those things that we were taught that we were supposed to do. And it was in the early 2000s when the Women's Health Initiative study came out and women were throwing their hormones out and everybody was feeling terrible. And I had a bunch of women in my practice that were Suzanne Summers devotees. And I said all the things I was taught to say, just because it's natural doesn't mean it's safe. And, you know, rattlesnake venom is natural and that's not healthy for you. You know, we need to stick with what we have the data on. And now I look back on things I used to say and I just cringe, but that's part of the journey, right? It's part of the evolution. But anyway, in the mid-2000s, I converted my practice into a concierge medical practice. And that gave me a huge opportunity to slow down and really explore my own intellectual curiosity. And out of that, I found functional medicine because I was recognizing that these patients I had that were doing things that I wasn't recommending were looking better and feeling better, and their labs looked better than the ones that I was doing what I thought I was supposed to do. And so that, you know, kind of spiked my curiosity. And what can I learn and how can I learn that? And so that led me through a whole another journey where I eventually found functional medicine and then founded this center. And now we run a good-sized center here, multidisciplinary with multiple practitioners. And we do both primary care from a functional medicine, so a root cause perspective. And then we also do complex chronic illness unraveling and reversal of chronic diseases. So that's what I do.
Yeah. And you just moved to a new facility. Congratulations on that. Is it nearby the former clinic?
Yeah, it is. It's only one freeway exit up. So same general area, just a bigger, beautiful building.
Great. So how did you end up with an interest in cardiometabolic concerns? Was that just part of this process you've been in, just as learning that, you know, focusing on that?
Yeah. So one of the things that I did early on when I was learning about root cause medicine is I actually did the Bale Dineen preceptorship. That's kind of a bridge between conventional medicine and more integrative medicine. And so that was the first time that I really looked at cardiovascular disease through the lens of inflammation. And then, of course, as I went on to do more functional medicine training, we all learned that looking upstream, looking for the root causes of inflammation is part of unraveling most chronic disease. So since cardiovascular disease is the number one killer, you really can't do primary care without facing that. And so, you know, I started off doing, you know, a few things and trying to understand more about the risk stratification because that had always fascinated me. Because, of course, in my conventional practice, I had patients that I thought I was doing a really good job of taking care of them, and then they would go on to have an MI or need a vascularization procedure. And so I was fascinated with trying to unravel how we could understand and see those risk factors and see that problem coming and then change that trajectory. So that was kind of how I started getting into it. And then the more you get into it, the more you learn, the more you understand what you can manipulate. And so it just kind of pulls you in.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. I love to get further into this now because, you know, we talked about discussing the glycocalyx and the endothelial lining, and I think it'd be beneficial just to do like a tour of the cardiovascular system and the vessels and just kind of fly in to that system and explain what we would see if we were standing in the middle of a vessel and all the components that we'd be looking at when considering the health of an individual.
Yeah. So, well, we have about 60,000 miles of blood vessels that are coiled up in our body. So that's enough to go around the world 2.5 times. So it has an enormous surface area. And part of that, you know, so we know about the arteries and the veins and the capillaries, but all of those vessels are lined with a single cell layer inner lining that's called the endothelium. And it's the endothelium that we have always, not always, but that we have in the last couple of decades focused on trying to protect and maintain the health of the endothelium, because that's the interface where things within the bloodstream get in under the wall. And then that's part of the developing plaque and then plaque progressing until we have a problem. So that was an earlier focus. Then the endothelial glycocalyx started to come onto the scene. So it was discovered a few decades ago, but as we well know, it takes, you know, a couple of decades before something is shown in the literature and the research until it becomes a part of clinical practice. And for many things, even longer than that. So the glycocalyx is this micro thin gel-like layer. Under an electron microscope, it actually looks like hair-like projections, but they aren't hairs. They're proteoglycans and glycosaminoglycans, these little fibrils. And as a mesh, they create this non-stick layer that's also highly negatively charged. And so that is what actually regulates the selective permeability of the blood vessels. It harbors our extracellular superoxide dismutase, an antioxidant enzyme that's very important, because those fibrils attach to the endothelial cells when the blood flows, that shear stress of the blood flowing through the vessel, that signal gets transduced into the endothelial cell, and then that stimulates the production of nitric oxide. And nitric oxide is necessary for the relaxation of the blood vessels. So as it turns out, while the endothelium is extraordinarily important, it cannot be healthy without a healthy endothelial glycocalyx. So it's just another level up that we've now learned about. And what's nice about that is, in a way, it's easier to target because it's damaged by all of the things that we're aware of in terms of our lifestyle habits, not getting enough sleep, having too much sugar, having too many inflammatory foods, or just inflammation in the body for other reasons. All of those types of things damage the glycocalyx, and then that impairs all of those actions that it's supposed to have. And then that impacts the health of the endothelium, the health of the blood vessel, and ultimately the health of every tissue and organ in the body.
Yeah.
Wow. So it sounds like it has a separate function on top of the endothelial layer that helps sort of regulate the response of the endothelial layer.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
Okay. And if we were to say to anybody walking around, like, clinically, how could you even pick up on that someone has a glycocalyx problem? Is it, it's not symptoms, it's more of something that we would expect to happen in a certain population?
Yeah, no, that's a really great question. So I think it's such a core thing that it's not something that you're going to know needs attention until a disease process has developed. And that's way too late. So we really need to be assessing it early as a preventative strategy so that we can identify if there's problems, we can support it if it needs to be supported so that we don't develop those end organ diseases. So the, one of the more common things that we see related to glycocalyx damage is going to be plaque development, plaque within the artery wall. And the other one that we commonly see is high blood pressure. So high blood pressure, stiffening of the artery wall, happens with that depletion of nitric oxide, and then also the inflammation within the wall of the vessel that occurs when that lining is not protected by that glycocalyx.
Yeah, it's great to see these pieces come together because I think, you know, when most people go to their primary care doctor, you know, the emphasis is on getting the cholesterol down as the main prevention, but it's not so much the cholesterol is sort of the fuel for the damage, but the health of the vessel is so much important. So they're both very important, right?
Right. So the exactly what you said, the cholesterol is kind of the building block of plaque, but it's not going to get through an intact endothelium and an intact glycocalyx layer. So it takes both. It's kind of like if you have a house with no windows in a hurricane, that's going to be a lot more damaged than one that's sealed up tight and has that protection. And that's really, that protection is what that glycocalyx provides for us.
Okay. So if a pathologist was to describe an unhealthy glycocalyx layer versus a healthy glycocalyx layer, what kinds of things would they comment on?
So one of the pictures that I absolutely love, and I use this a lot when I'm teaching about this topic, is a scanning electron micrograph of a tiny rat artery. And it just has this beautiful picture of all these little fibers of the glycocalyx protruding into the blood vessel. And then a secondary picture where the glycocalyx has been damaged. And it looks like instead of having this, you know, nice long fibers, there's tufts that are missing, kind of like a mangy dog, right? There's patches that are missing, and it's short or it's real stubby. It's been broken off. And so it's a really, really great educational tool to help patients to see what a big difference there is between those two. And in those pictures, they can do that simply by infusing a high level of glucose, an achievable level of glucose, like what we can get, like when we have insulin resistance or prediabetes, or for sure in diabetes. And that's one of the reasons why by the time someone gets diagnosed with diabetes, as we know, which is a couple of decade process, by the time they reach that finish line of diagnosis, they have the cardiovascular event equivalent, the risk of having a heart attack, that's the same as someone who's already had a heart attack. Because all of those years of high blood sugar have damaged that endothelial glycocalyx. So we have a lot of blood vessel damage.
So glucose, hypertension, these are two main drivers of glycocalyx damage. What about just having high cholesterol? Is that a factor in damaging the glycocalyx, or is it sort of necessary only for forming a plaque?
Well, it's a little hard to tease that out. I think that in part, our perception of just high cholesterol is that we're often only thinking about either the total cholesterol or we're only thinking about the LDL. And what we know when we do advanced lipid profiling and we're looking at the LDL particle number, we're looking at the number of small, dense particles that are going to penetrate the artery wall more readily, as opposed to those large, fluffy LDL molecules. So the different sizes of the particles make a big difference in how damaging that they are. So it isn't always just about the total as it is about what that total is made up of. So I think at a certain level of elevation, there's just going to be some damage because there's too much pelting of the artery wall. But usually those levels of elevated cholesterol don't occur in the absence of other things that are driving inflammation as well, right? So that's happening as a consequence often of either the unhealthy dietary choices and lifestyle, but then also often driven by the other sources of inflammation, whether that's food driven, that's not specifically sugar, like processed foods and high chemical foods, or if it's maybe other types of toxins that the person's being exposed to, whether those are chemical toxins, environmental toxins, biological toxins, like mold related toxins. All of those things also create damage within the vessel wall. The vessel takes a lot. It takes a lot of heat. It definitely needs to be supported.
Yeah, this is sort of veering a little bit to another system of the body, but I'm curious if this study of the glycocalyx is going into other organ systems like brain, kidney, liver, spleen.
Yes, absolutely. Literally every part of the body is supplied by blood vessels, and every single blood vessel, even the tiniest capillary, has a glycocalyx. So, yep, this applies across all tissues, all organs. Every system is impacted by this.
Wow. Yeah. So, when you think about that concept of inflammaging or meta inflammation, this is like a unifying component.
Mm-hmm. For sure, it is.
Yeah. Didn't even mention like eyes and other end organs that, you know, could be affected by this. So that's really fascinating. When in the patient process are you saying, hey, I think we need to evaluate the health of your endothelial tissue or your glycocalyx? And can you even do that in a way that's reasonable for people to do?
Yeah, that's a great question. So every patient and always every year, so our primary care patients, we test them at least once a year. If it's abnormal, then we'll retest to follow to make sure that we've normalized the values. But I actually am on the Scientific Medical Advisory Board for Calrite Health Sciences. And so we literally, in combination with Ovation Lab, just developed this vascular health protocol to help practitioners be able to apply these concepts in any practice setting. And so that's readily available. I can give you the information to put in the show notes. But really what we want to start off with are looking for the markers of vascular inflammation. So that's looking specifically at damage. So there's already damage happening. So we're trying to figure out how bad the problem is. So for that, I look at the LPPLA2, the lipoprotein phospholipase A2, which is specific to the lining of the blood vessel. That's the macrophage foam cell that's being stimulated as it's gobbling up the oxidized LDL. In that process, it's releasing that LPPLA2. So if you find that elevated, that means that there is a fire in the vessel wall somewhere in the body. And then myeloperoxidase, which is mostly specific to what's happening within that inflamed plaque, although there are some other things that can cause myeloperoxidase to be elevated. But if it's elevated in combination with LPPLA2, then there is a significant multiplier of risk of a cardiovascular event. And MPO is generally looked at to signify the stability of the fibrous cap on the plaque. So you can have plaque that's kind of cold, hard, and stabilized. It's not great to have any plaque, but that plaque is far less dangerous than plaque that's hot and inflamed. And a good analogy to that is a volcano, right? If you have a dormant volcano, yes, there's still all that stuff there, all that lava is still there, but you're not really at risk from that. But if it's bubbling and boiling and ready to rupture, that's when a cardiovascular event happens, either the heart attack or the stroke, as we well know. So looking at those markers can really help you to identify those people who don't have any symptoms, but are at potentially significant risk. So those are two of my primary go-tos. I also use the ADMA, the asymmetric dimethyl arginine. It's a test that you can get easily.
I'm glad you know that acronym.
Cleveland Heart Lab, you know that?
Oh, well, I'm glad you know the spelling out of that acronym. It's a tough one.
I know. Well, as soon as I said it, I was like, well, I hope this rolls off my tongue. I'm not sure it will, but it did. So we're good.
It was beautiful. Yeah.
So the ADMA is a marker of how robustly the production of nitric oxide is happening. And so when ADMA goes up, nitric oxide production is poor. And so that's one of the easiest ways that you can measure how that endothelial health is happening. And remember, it's the shear stress of the glycocalyx that's stimulating that nitric oxide production. That's our endogenous pathway. And so we can start to see those pieces of the puzzle coming together. And then I also like to look at a carotid CIMT, the intimal medial thickness. So a conventional Doppler carotid ultrasound is just looking for obstructive disease. And it just kills me that I'll get these scans back and it'll say, you know, less than 70% blockage. And then in the impression, in the summary, no clinically significant stenosis. And you're like, okay, people, are we not paying attention to the statistics that 70% of heart attacks happen in people who have less than a 70% stenosis? The 70-70 rule. Please remember that. Because if you're waiting until something is clogging up the artery, you're missing 70% of people who are going to have an event from a plaque rupture. So by doing the CIMT and looking at what the burden of plaque is there, we can get an idea of what's going on in the heart arteries and the coronary arteries in the brain, because there's about an 80% correlation with what we see here, readily accessible with what we see in the other places that are a little harder to get to. So I like using that. And I'm really looking at not just, okay, do they have bad plaque? That's always bad. But are they making plaque? Yes or no? Because in a perfect world, when my patient and I as a team have everything dialed in, they're not making any plaque. Even old 90-year-olds I have without plaque. So we're looking for the plaque piece. And then we're also looking at the thickness of that CIMT. That correlates with vascular aging. And so the vascular lining ages, if you will, or thickens in response to inflammation. So that's also another marker that's giving me information about the health of the endothelium.
Wow, that's great. And so
I could go on, but I figured it was probably time to pause and let you ask me something.
So it's kind of like, is early in the process, you do kind of that whole panel, that whole look, and that's kind of your preventative cardiology baseline approach.
Yep, exactly. Looking at the high sensitivity CRP, looking at some urine markers for oxidation, looking at the oxidized LDL. So damage markers, those are all pieces of the puzzle as well. So then we get a sense, you know, they have an excess load of oxidative stress. If we have dysfunction of the endothelium with the high ADMA, we know that they also have depletion of the SOD, the superoxide dismutase. So they have a lowered capacity to quench the free radicals. So free radicals that are coming in are going to do more damage in that person if they don't have the counterbalance to that. So it's just all this web of connection, like these things usually are, where each piece of the puzzle impacts all of the other pieces.
Have you ever seen that meme of Homer Simpson when he's like, goes back into the field when he's embarrassed? Have you ever seen that one?
I don't think I have.
Okay. Well, I would imagine if an LDL panel was sitting here listening to this conversation, it doesn't have much to offer.
It does not have much to offer.
Yeah, like so basic compared to all this rich detail. I mean, I guess it's probably, I shouldn't be so snooty about it, because like from a public health perspective and like large group population studies, it probably really helped point us in a direction we needed to know about. But we're here today and we have this information. So it'd be great if this starts to be more available to the masses.
Yeah. And I think part of it is that, you know, the science keeps progressing, but sometimes as clinicians, we don't necessarily keep up with that. And I don't mean just personally reading the literature, but it's not brought to us. It's not brought into our awareness. And so it's all happening, but we don't know about it. And the big organizations aren't really talking about it. And I think, you know, if you think about what you have to offer as a conventionally trained physician, there's not a lot of education about what we do with inflammology. Like we see it, okay, we know it's bad, but we don't really know, like, how do we alter that course? And so I think that's true with a lot of these things. If someone hasn't been trained in what do you do with this, then our natural tendency is to not want to order tests that we don't know what to do with, or we don't think that there's anything that we can do about them. That really slows that progress, I think.
So is there any additional, like the test that you were talking about that you sit on the board for, is this like a bedside device also that you can use with people to look at blood flow? Or is this sort of looking at all the umbrella of tests that you were talking about and kind of putting the picture together?
Yeah, it's definitely more the latter. Call was to make this approachable by any physician, any healthcare provider in a primary care setting, because that really is where this needs to be happening. I'm doing a summit interview for Fullscript here coming up for their summit on cardiovascular disease. And that's exactly what we're talking about. How do we get this information into the hands of the providers that can really have the greatest impact? Because most patients don't make it to a cardiologist until it's after the fact.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then the first thing the cardiologist asks, which isn't wrong because it's still super valuable, is, do you have symptoms? Well, but oftentimes, if the patient says, no, they don't have symptoms, then they say, well, everything looks okay, and they send them on their way. But for more than half, in some studies, as much as 70% of people, the first symptom of their cardiovascular disease is a heart attack.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right? So if we're waiting for symptoms, then we're, by definition, we're sacrificing 70% of the population.
So well said. I mean, I guess you could assume after a certain standpoint that someone needs to work on their glycocalyx, and it's just sort of as a preventative move, and, you know, right up there with other cardiovascular concerns like keeping blood pressure in check, keeping your cholesterol and glucose stable. So part of this term, dietary glycocalyx precursors. So these are things that we can take or eat or supplement with that can strengthen or improve the health of the glycocalyx. Can you talk a little bit about those?
Yeah. So the glycocalyx, as we talked about at the very beginning, is made up of these proteoglycans and glycosaminoglycans. And so there are some building blocks that we can access. They're not generally things that we eat a lot of, other than the sulfur foods. I mean, pretty much anytime you're talking about health, right, you always end up talking about the cruciferous vegetables because they just have magic in them. So the sulfur source of that can help with our exogenous production of nitric oxide. So that brings in that component. Also, the components within the glycocalyx are heavily sulfated. The most abundant component is heparan sulfate, heparan, not heparin with an I. And there's some other glycosaminoglycans. Their hyaluronic acid is sometimes a component, glucosamine, but those are definitely lesser players. The fucoidins in seaweed have been studied, but the most potent regenerative compound that's been found is rhamnon sulfate, and that also comes from a brown seaweed. And that's the active ingredient in the supplement that I have my patients use when we're trying to reverse plaque, or it's actually patented to reverse plaque when we have those types of situations, or if we have somebody with higher risk that we want to be supporting the glycocalyx, or if they have family history, or they just want to improve the health of their vascular system, because the more robust that glycocalyx is, the more robust the health of the vascular system. So those are the food, substance, and supplement sources that we can bring in as the building blocks. But the interesting thing about the glycocalyx is that it's pretty fragile. It's very easily damaged, but it also can be pretty quickly repaired and regenerated. So it has a very flexible lifespan where it can go up and down. And so you can bring it back with things like this. But if you're continuing to bring in the damaging substances, then you're just doing like we often see, right? Like if you're bringing in the damaging components, then you're going to continue to have damage. I often say to people, I cannot out supplement your lifestyle choices, right? You have to make good lifestyle choices, and then we can do a lot to improve your health.
So true. Yeah. I mean, getting to being able to just exercise alone is start with that. But, you know, rightfully so, sometimes I've seen people have to kind of work backwards and get some support, nutrition or supplements or some type of get feeling a little bit better with their energy, their pain, and then they're able to kind of implement some of the better lifestyle strategies. So it's not always like one way or the other. I don't know if you feel the same way, but like after 19, 20 years of banging my head against the wall, trying to get everybody to follow this specific order, I've found that you just enter where you enter.
I really agree with you. And I think, you know, one of my functional medicine educators along the way, probably many of them have, you know, said, first, alleviate suffering, because your suffering patient cannot help themselves, or rarely can help themselves. There are people who can manage to pull up from there, but most of us have a really hard time doing the things that we need to do when we're suffering, or like you said, in pain or horrendously fatigued. And so we do need to work on those things to help get people where they can start to do the things that are going to help them to build health, right? So we're going to get out of the hole a bit first and try to bring those, you know, what we can, the little baby steps.
Yeah, I think that's important for people to hear that message, you know, and for practitioners to embrace that. I just think we'll have a lot more people become successful in this kind of path. So this has been really great. I want to kind of just go into some kind of quick questions if they are of interest to you. If not, we can just move through them. But I just really love to hear your whole thoughts, because we're talking about the endothelial tissue, about this whole vitamin K2 question, because that's been touted as a really important part of this issue we're talking about. What is your current state of the address about K2?
Yeah, so K2, specifically in that MK7 form, what it does is it directs calcium into the bone, as opposed to calcium being laid down where there's other areas of inflammation. So part of the reason that arteries become calcified is that that calcium deposition is part of the cooling of the inflammation, or it's the body's attempt to, you know, toss the blanket on it. And so if we don't have K2 present, then calcium more readily goes into the artery wall. That's commonly one of the places that has a lot of inflammation. And so I think having the K2 is really important. And I think at the same time, not overdoing the free calcium, because we don't need tons of calcium. You know, usually that's done to try to maintain bone health, but the bones can't lay down new bone if there's a ton of inflammation, because inflammation stimulates the osteoclasts, the bone breakdown cells. And so you're breaking down bone faster than you can build it. And then if you don't have K2, it's not going to the bone anyway. It's going to the other more higher priority targets that are actively inflamed, actively on fire. So it's just this environment of dysregulation. I mean, I'm calling it dysregulation, but it's really how we're designed, right? We're designed to put out the fire where the fire is going to kill us. And if that means we have to suck all the calcium out of our bones to keep our arteries from exploding, then that is the prioritization that the body takes. So each one of these things, like, we can get profound improvements in bone density by focusing on vascular health and reducing the inflammation. So all of those pieces come together around this conversation with K2 and calcium.
That's great. I really like how you explain that. And it's so nice that now they're putting vitamin D together with K2 and our supplements. So because they're just working on that calcium balance regulation together.
Yes, exactly. Well, because for a long time, we were all giving people vitamin D because we all know how important vitamin D is, but we weren't including the K2. And so we were increasing their calcium absorption while we were focusing on the vitamin D for their immune health. And then we had all this extra calcium absorption, but we didn't have the traffic cop, the K2, directing it into the right place. So yeah, I agree with you. I really appreciate that most are doing that now too.
Yeah. And does fish oil help with this endothelial health?
Yeah. So omega-3s are a super important membrane component.
Or I should say that omega-3s, right? Because fish oil is just a type of omega-3.
Yeah. I knew what you meant. So the cell membrane should have at least 8% of the membrane components to be the EPA and DHA. And generally, there's a lot of different discussion around the ratios, but usually it's kind of like a 4-3 when you're looking at cardiovascular health. But when we don't have enough of the omega-3s, just looking at it from a cell membrane, and that's every cell in your body should have that percentage. So if you're low, I mean, think about how much omega-3 you need to replenish the membrane of every cell in your body. That's why we need so much. And our diet, typically as Americans, doesn't include a lot of high omega-3 fish. Even when we eat fish, culturally, we tend to choose white fish that are mild in flavor and therefore have very little omega-3s. There's a great chart. I don't know if you happen to use OmegaQuant. I love their test, but there's a great chart that they have that has all the fish and then what the typical content of omega-3s is. And it's just crazy, you know, like cod is way at the bottom, like 73 or something like that. And then you have salmon, wild caught salmon, which is like 1800. And it's like all fish is not created equal when you're looking at omega-3s, but I digress. So the membrane fluidity, the flexibility of the membrane is really dependent in part on the omega-3 content, as well as the other important phospholipids, the phosphatidylcholine, phosphatidylethanolamine, phosphatidylinositol.
Yeah, it also, just to kind of add to that, that you can get omega-3 from vegan sources, algae also. And so you can get it from flax and chia.
Flax, walnuts, chia.
Takes a little bit more work to make it into certain components of that, but just so people who are listening to this know that it doesn't, you know, have to be from animal sources altogether.
Mm-hmm. And it does take a lot more work in terms of the volume of what you need to take in to be able to achieve those levels. But yeah, so you just have to pay attention. And that's where the testing can be really useful, because then you know if you're hitting the mark or you need to change up what you're doing.
Yeah. Some current news that just came out like last week. I don't know if you saw the article that came out in the New England Journal of Medicine, where they found like microplastics in the atherosclerotic plaques. Can you comment on the whole environmental medicine piece of this? Because it's just kind of mind-blowing when you start thinking about what's ending up in clogging our arteries.
I have not seen that article yet, but I will be looking it up now. That's really fascinating. And it doesn't surprise me at all, because microplastics are so pervasive. And because of the nature of their small size, they can get into every, you know, damaged nook and cranny. So that doesn't surprise me at all. I think, you know, we could have a whole conversation about the environmental medicine piece. You know, way back in 2012, the World Health Organization put out kind of a state of the science on endocrine disrupting chemicals. And that their summary of the existing data at that time was 300 pages. And that was in 2012. And we know a lot more now than we knew then. So there's so much about the chemicals in our environment, plastics included, that create changes in the way our body communicates, that alter our signaling pathways, that impact, now we know, the health of the arterial wall. There's a lot to what's going on in the environment and how that impacts our health.
Yeah, I remember when I first started practicing, there was a big move on chelation for atherosclerosis. I don't know if that's still a thing, is it?
So they did quite a few studies. So the first study was really profoundly beneficial, doing lead chelation mostly. Well, EDTA, so calcium disodium EDTA. And it was really effective. But then as they tried to tease it down a little bit further, it was less effective when they tried to take it to the next level. And I can't remember the specifics. I just remember that as they did more studies, they became less enamored with it as a potential intervention. I think it reminds me, if you will, a bit of the amyloid removal drugs. I think that plaque in the artery is a response to inflammation and sometimes even infection. And the plaque is part of that, like trying to create a salve, a healing bandage over that wounded tissue. Just like amyloid plaque, I believe, is in the brain. It's part of the patching process of trying to save the brain from having more damage from whatever it is that's going on. But over time, it's too much. And then the help becomes the harm. And so if you just go in to an Alzheimer's patient's brain and start sucking out the amyloid with these drugs, then you see exactly what you see. Just like if you rip a Band-Aid off, the wound will bleed. If you start ripping the plaque, the amyloid, whether it's cardiac plaque or amyloid plaque, then you're going to have tissue damage because it's too much too soon. You have to create the environment in which the healing can occur before you can start, you know, shoveling all that stuff out. So I don't know that there's not a place for those drugs. There may be. once we've done this other work, like what we're doing in the Deventer reversal trial that I'm involved in right now, once you've done that work so that you've slowed or you've stopped that ongoing damage, then you can start to try to remove the thing that's getting in the way. And I wonder if that's not analogous to what may have happened in those EDTA trials.
That makes sense. Thank you for explaining that. So this has been really interesting. I really have learned a lot. I appreciate you walking through so many details. It's really helpful. It's exciting to know there's so many tools that we have to really improve. But like you said, it's the number one cause of death. So obviously, the more tools, we need these tools and we need to implement them. So I was wondering if you could just leave us with just a take-home message or two, or just some closing thoughts. And, you know, again, I thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks. I really do appreciate the opportunity to talk about this. I love talking about it. I love helping people to have a better understanding. And I think, you know, one of the take-home messages that I would leave as well, there is an enormous amount of complexity in all of this stuff. I don't know if you've picked up a copy of Dr. Mark Houston's Integrative Precision Cardiology. There's a lot behind this, but when you really get down to it, the things that we need on the front line are not that complicated. And they're readily accessible labs that we can do at Quest and Cleveland Heart Lab, which is now part of Quest. So easy to get to. There's lots of other labs that do it, but those are particularly readily accessible. And so I think not feeling like you have to get sucked down into the weeds and join me in the biochemical minutia, but that you can really do this at a more macro level, which is just understanding, is my patient making plaque? Yes or no? Because if they are, then I need to do something different. Is that plaque inflamed? Yes or no? Because if it is, my patient is at risk of having a cardiovascular event. And that's not acceptable. And we need to be, you know, pulling out all the stops to try to shut down that inflammation. And interestingly, that's a place where statins can be very useful. Part of the reason when someone has an MI and they're in the ICU that they get a statin right away is not because lowering their cholesterol is going to help them in that acute moment. It's because statins have a vascular anti-inflammatory effect. And so we can capitalize on that too. So I will often use off-label, of course, statins for a couple weeks, 2 weeks, 4 weeks to get that LPPLA2 down acutely. Then I can work on, in the background on the other things. So all of these tools, they're readily available. We don't have to have fancy glycocalyx detecting equipment. There is some. We don't have to have fancy endothelial function testing. There's lots of that. I used to have one. And I just found that while it was great information, it didn't really change what I needed to do with patients at the level that I was working with them on. And so I think that's the message that I would most like to get out, is that this is doable and accessible for anyone. And I went 10 years without a heart attack in my practice. I just had one. It was a silent MI. I was like, well, if it was silent and she didn't know it happened, do I have to count that? Yes, I have to count that.
Well, that's a pretty good track record. I mean, I don't think too many medical doctors can say that. So congratulations and thanks for all you do for your patients and fighting for their health and giving them the best of the best. So
thanks so much.
I know we'll put a number of the references in the show notes that you mentioned and look forward to kind of continue to learn from you.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode of the One Thing Podcast. Please share these episodes with your friends, loved ones, colleagues, patients, healthcare providers, anyone who you feel might benefit from hearing these informative interviews. We tend to learn best from people sharing things with us. That's often the first time it's introduced. So don't hesitate if the content of these episodes reminded you of someone that might benefit from that. Forward the episode to them, and I'm sure they'll either appreciate it or be appreciative that you've thought of them. So once again, we'll look forward to seeing you next episode on the One Thing Podcast. And again, much appreciation for you being here with me.